Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. I'm Ann Clark, a member of the Commonwealth Club and chair of the Environment and Natural Resources member-led forum. Our program tonight is the 30-year plan, what we need to build a better future, from the acclaimed Orion Magazine and 30 writers that they have asked to comment on a better future. It is with great pleasure that I introduce H. Emerson Blake, who is editor-in-chief of Orion Magazine, who will introduce us, to introduce all of us, to our distinguished panel. Thank you.
Thank you, Anne, and thank you to the Commonwealth Club of California for inviting us to be here today, and thanks to all of you for being here with us as well. It's a beautiful day out there, and I know you have a lot of other places you could be, and I'm glad you decided to be here with us. It's exciting to be here on this stage where so many remarkable people have stood or sat over the years, and it's exciting to be in collaboration with the Commonwealth Club. I think the Commonwealth Club and Orion both stand in a world that is increasingly defined by 140 character sound bites. The Commonwealth Club and Orion stand for an in-depth, comprehensive exploration of the issues that define the world and the ideas that make the world a safer, saner place. Orion is currently celebrating its 30th anniversary, and as is the case with most anniversaries, that involves a certain amount of looking back, and we've been looking back at the history of the magazine, how the magazine has changed, how the issues that the magazine has reported on for years has changed. And that looking back is mostly a humbling process, because when you look back and you see how the content has changed, you see that the world mostly has become a thornier, hotter, more crowded, and less predictable place. It also reveals that we have come to recognize that the roots of the environmental crisis are far deeper and more embedded than we once might have realized, that the way the environmental crisis is entwined with other cultural problems is deeper than we had realized, and that the solutions that we all need are more complex and more urgent than we had thought. But in that reflection, in that looking back on the magazine's history, we also found ourselves talking a lot and thinking a lot about the next 30 years, where we need to go culturally to end up in a different place. We found ourselves asking, what are the things that humans are going to need more of in the next 30 years if we're going to be on a more sustainable, happier planet? We talked and wondered about this enough that we decided that we would put this question out to some other people, to writers, to artists, to historians, to economists, to business people, and to invite their responses. And in the end, we decided to put this question out to 30 people and to ask them specifically to tell us, describe one thing that humanity is going to need in order to build a better future, one with more possibilities, less hand-wringing, and more joy. Orion published the results in a small book, which we call 30-Year Plan, which was edited by Orion editor Jennifer Son. In 30-Year Plan, Patagonia founder Yvon Chouinard writes about the need for a consumer revolution in which people demand products that are manufactured as responsibly as possible. Elizabeth Colbert writes about the need to shift the way we think about climate change. Poet Nikki Giovanni writes about the need to embrace fear and describes it as a spice that we need more of. Poet Jane Hirschfield writes about the need to embrace optimism and describes it as a ground note. Richard Louv writes about the need to get children out of doors. Tamara Adler and Severin von Charmer Fleming argue that cultural systems need to become more organized around food. Terry Tempest Williams writes about the need for a new concept of global citizenship. I'm delighted to be here today with three of the book's authors. Ruben Martinez is a native of Los Angeles and the son and grandson of immigrants from Mexico and El Salvador. He is a writer, performer, and teacher, and holds the Fletcher Jones Chair in Literature and Writing at Loyola Marymount University, and is an artist in residence at Stanford University's Institute for Diversity in the Arts. He is the author of several books, including the acclaimed Crossing Over, A Mexican Family on the Migrant Trail, and most recently, Desert America, Boom or Bust, Boom and Bust in the Old New, in the New Old West. Ruben is also an Emmy Award-winning journalist, a documentary screenwriter, and a musician. Rianne Eisler is a writer, attorney, systems scientist, and president of the Center for Partnership Studies, a nonprofit organization working to create a more peaceful, equitable, and sustainable world through cultural transformation. Her seminal book, The Chalice and the Blade, has been published in 25 foreign editions, and her book, The Real Wealth of Nations, was hailed by Archbishop Desmond Tutu as a template for the better world we have been so urgently seeking. Rianne is a leader in the movements for peace, environmental sustainability, economic equity, and human rights, and her work and ideas are widely applied in many organizations. She lives in Carmel. Craig Childs writes about the relationship between humans, animals, and landscape and time. His stories come from visceral personal experience, whether in the company of illicit artifact dealers or in deep wilderness. His most recent book is Apocalyptic Planet, which won the 2013 Orion Book Award 3 weeks ago. His work has appeared in many magazines and newspapers, and he is a commentator for National Public Radio's Morning Edition. He lives in Crawford, Colorado. I'm now going to turn the program over to our three authors, who will talk about how they arrived at the idea of what they wrote about in 30-Year Plan and why they think that idea, among all others, is one that can make a difference in building a better world. When they're finished, we'll invite comments from the audience, and we look forward to your thoughts and questions. Ruben, we'll begin with you.
Thank you very much, Chip. Thank you to Anne and the Commonwealth Club, and to all of you for coming today, to my fellow panelists. It's an honor to be here with them. We've been told to stick to time, so I'm using my iPhone. It's ticking, 9:57. I'm here to talk about the desert. I've just returned from the desert. I'm a desert rat. I'm a desert guy. I go out into the desert. I should have a long beard and a staff. I go out on journeys into the desert, which are physical and cultural and spiritual. I've been doing that for a long time. I'm part native and part stranger to the desert. I was born in Los Angeles, which is not actually desert, although some people call it a cultural desert, but we know natives of Los Angeles that that's not really true. My father, though, my grandparents are both natives of northern Mexican desert lands. And when we were growing up, my father would take us out on shoestring family vacations into the Coachella Valley. August, dead of August, the hottest month of the year, cheapest motel rates, not in Palm Springs, but in Indio, 30 miles east into the furnace. And those were magical times when I was a kid, because everything from our life in Los Angeles would be flipped over. It would be midnight, 100 degrees outside, and we'd be in the swimming pool. It was a magical landscape. The difference, the stark difference of it, really sparked my childhood imagination. And as an adult, I returned to it in the late 90s under very dark personal circumstances. I was lucky enough to be on contract for a book about Mexican migrants, and had been living and working in Mexico City. And I won't tell you the whole long sad tale here, except other than to say, like many writers who are lucky to have book deals with advances, I had spent the entire advance, didn't have a single word written, broken, and, by way of confession, on drugs in Mexico City. I went to the only place that I had friends left that I could count on, having destroyed most of my personal relationships, and that happened to be the small village of Joshua Tree, California, because it was a coincidence that one of my close and oldest friends had left Los Angeles and gone to live at the edge of the famous national park. How many people have been to Joshua Tree, California? Many of us. It's an enchanted landscape. We go there in spring for the wildflowers. We go for the Perseid meteor shower. It's an amazing landscape. It's iconic. It's in Star Trek. And I went. I didn't see much of the landscape, though. I was kind of howling kind of dark place, but slowly started bringing my life back together and realized at a certain point that by journeying into the desert at that point in my life, I was undertaking a journey very similar to spiritual journeys that have been going on for thousands of years into the desert. Indeed, you'll find those tales in many of the great desert religions. And I started to become aware of this aura, historical aura, of the desert as healing place. But even as I was pulling my life back together on that beautiful landscape, in the peace and quiet, in the fragile beauty of it, I realized that there was another reality overlaid, and that was much more complicated. Joshua Tree, the village, is a very poor town. The poverty rate there is much higher than in Los Angeles, for example. But people don't really see that poverty when they go through because they're just blowing through the town to get to their wonderful campsite in the national park. And because the tourist strip kind of like serves as a wallpaper beyond which we can't see the poverty of that landscape. Also, I had gone to escape the desert of drugs in my own life, but of course, meth is manufactured in the desert, and drugs from South America and from Mexico are crossing the border and across the desert to be then distributed across the country. So the fact of the drug war is there as well. Add on top of that the fact that the desert, when I arrived, was starting to explode in flame. The historic mega drought that most people agree now that we are entering into had begun already by the late 90s. And Joshua Tree National Park itself has suffered the biggest wildfires in its recorded history. The iconic Joshua Tree itself, just think of the iconic Joshua Tree with its arms stretched bizarrely every which way, in flames. Quite the prophetic sign. And my little journey into this landscape, once I had kind of like got my life back together enough so that I was aware of where I had really entered into, I realized that it was a much more complicated journey, that it wasn't just about me healing on that landscape, but me also becoming part of a constellation of relationships and being a neighbor to the addicts next door who weren't in recovery yet, like me, to the poverty next door, to the natural realm that I was a neighbor to, that I was at the urban-rural interface of. A few years later, I met my wife-to-be, Angela Garcia, anthropologist now at Stanford University. She was doing her dissertation research, and we fell in love because of the desert. She's from the South Valley of Albuquerque, which has been given high literary treatment by the likes of Jimmy Santiago Baca and others. And she said, do you want to join me while I do my dissertation research? I'm going to be living in northern New Mexico, in a small village alongside the Rio Grande. And I, by this point, this is a few years after Joshua Tree now, I'd gotten my life back together. I said, yes, absolutely, that sounds amazing. I was in Taos once, I was in Santa Fe, that's an amazing landscape. And I had kind of like the experience of that innocent kid looking out from my family's station wagon, going out into that Coachella landscape when I was a kid. I had a flash of kind of like that romantic experience of the desert again. I said, sure. And somehow the fact that I was going to be part of Angela's dissertation research, which was exploring the rate of heroin addiction in northern New Mexico, had receded to a dim corner of my mind. We spent the next 4 years living in northern New Mexico. Our neighbors, literally across the street from us, were dealers. They were also addicts. Another neighbor, kitty corner from us, was an addict. Another neighbor behind us was also an addict. We were on that landscape in the shadow of the Sangre de Cristo Mountains. How many people have been in northern New Mexico? We love the Sangre de Cristo Mountains. So does George O'Keefe. So does Ansel Adams. It's been represented in iconic American art for generations. But that frame somehow doesn't allow us to see beyond the enchanted landscape to the social schisms, and often to the schisms between us, the social realm, and the natural realm that we interface with. So on that landscape, I got a crash course an embodied experience of the abstraction of how philosophers talk about the neighbor, how philosophers talk about the ideal of hospitality. Our neighbors were in terrible trouble, but even though we were within 100 yards of their house and we could see their lives disintegrating, we felt helpless. We were scared. We didn't know what to do. Should we open our door to the mother when she was screaming and crying after a terrible argument? What about that 5-year-old kid? Should we call Children's Protective Services and kind of snitch on the family? Those 3 years, we struggled with that ethical dilemma. Ultimately, there was a death in my neighbor's house, and this is what I deal with in my book. So, theme of what we're talking about today is, what do we need to build a better future? To take seriously the idea that we are neighbors. And when I say that, that means the neighbor next door, literally. It means the neighbor across town. It means the neighboring town. It means the U.S.-Mexico border. It means the fact that the U.S.-Mexico border is that border that brings two disparate worlds together and brings them together through the tragedy of the drug war. I'm talking about the neighborly relationship of the rural-urban interface. I'm talking about the human and natural realms meeting. All these borders are very rigid structures that often keep us apart, that serve ultimately very narrow interests. Ultimately, what I argue here in the 30-year plan is that we have to take the idea of being each other's neighbor much more seriously if we have any chance of surviving in the future. 3 seconds left.
Ooh.
Thank you.
Well, it is a pleasure to be here with you. And first of all, can you hear me?
Yes.
Good, because I don't want to be talking to myself. I am going to be talking with you about a plan. That's right, a plan for building a better future. And this is an enterprise that those of you who are familiar with my work, with books such as The Chalice and the Blade, and more recently with The Real Wealth of Nations, know is an enterprise I have a very, very strong passion for. Not only through my research and my writing and my speaking and my organizing, but as a mother and a grandmother, deeply concerned, as so many of us are today, about what kind of future our children will inherit. And this passion is very, very deeply rooted in my own childhood. I was born in Vienna, and from one day to the next, when after the Anschluss, after the Austrians decided to unite with Nazi Germany, my whole world was rent asunder. And from being, this little girl that people patted on the head, my parents and I, we became hunted with license to kill. And it was on Kristallnacht, so-called because of all the glass that was shattered in Jewish homes, in synagogues, in businesses, that a gang of Gestapo men came, broke into our home, and dragged my father away. So very early, I witnessed, cruelty, barbarity, insensitivity. But I also that night witnessed something else, which just as profoundly affected me, and it's what I today call spiritual courage. And my mother displayed that courage, the courage to stand up against injustice out of love, because, you know, we're told courage is the courage to slay the dragon, to kill the enemy, right? But she recognized one of the Gestapo men as a young man who had worked for the family business as an errand boy. And she got furious. She said, "How dare you do this to this man who was so good to you? I want him back." Now, my mother could have been killed. Many people were killed that night. But by a miracle, she wasn't. By a miracle, and yes, some money eventually passed hands. We were lucky we had the money. We were able to escape at night from Vienna. And eventually, we ended up on one of the last ships admitted to Cuba before one that some of you may have heard about. It was called the St. Louis. A movie was made about it. It was called The Voyage of the Damned, because neither Cuba nor any other nation in the Western Hemisphere admitted that ship, and it had to go back to Europe, where, of course, many on board, 1,000 women, children, men, were killed in Nazi concentration camps. Now, these experiences obviously led me to questions, questions that many of us have asked. Does it have to be this way? Is it really, as we're so often told, just human nature, you know, selfish genes, original sin, what have you, or are there alternatives? And my whole research, really, was directed to answering these questions. And I'm going to focus with you very briefly now on something that is found by my research and that is very, very central to shifting to that more sustainable, more equitable, less cruel, more caring world, radically, fundamentally changing how we think about economics. Because, yes, as I grew up in the slums, you know, the industrial slums of Havana, I also, of course, for the first time, experienced devastating, stark poverty, the kind of poverty that you still have. So many people of color in this rich nation still experience, you know, with the cockroaches and the rats. So I really can relate to that, too, on a very visceral level. Now, when I say fundamentally changing our economic system, that is really the subject of my book, The Real Wealth of Nations, and of the Caring Economy Campaign, which is a campaign that is coordinated by the Center for Partnership Studies, which is the organization that I'm president of. And one of the things that I'm going to be focusing on with you, and one of our aims, is to change how we measure economic success. Why? Because if we're measuring it wrong, then we're going to have what we've got, a very dysfunctional economic system, dysfunctional rules, dysfunctional policies. So I want to start with something, with measurements, but with some questions, because most of us aren't aware of this. Did you know, for example, that environmental disaster, war, imprisonment, that all of these end up registering as growth in GDP, in that famous, much publicized gross domestic product that policymakers base their policies on, my friends? Did you know that GDP does not measure human well-being, environmental sustainability, and even long-term economic success, as I'll get to in a little bit? Did you also know that this wealthy nation has the highest infant mortality rates and the highest child poverty rates, as well as almost the highest maternal mortality rates of any developed nation? Now, this does not show up in GDP. So clearly, we're not going to be able to meet our unprecedented environmental, economic, social challenges if we continue to rely on these faulty measures. So we obviously need two things to start with. New economic thinking that goes beyond the old tired argument between capitalism and socialism. And we also need new economic measures that really recognize something that once articulated, it's going to sound perfectly self-obvious to you, which is that the real wealth of a nation, the real wealth of our world, is not financial. We saw that, didn't we, with the melting into thin air of all those derivatives, those credit swaps. The real wealth of a nation, of the world, consists of the contributions of people and of nature. So what is required now is an economic system that recognizes the economic value, that's right, that gives visibility and real value to the most important human work, the work of caring for people, starting in early childhood throughout the lifespan, and caring for nature. And I know that people do a double take. Some of you probably did, just hearing caring and economics in the same sentence, right? But tell me, isn't that a terrible comment on how conditioned we have become to accepting that economic systems should be driven by uncaring values? And it doesn't have to be that way. And this is what the Caring Economy campaign is about. If you look at our economic measures, as I said, you know, GDP, they don't make sense. We need to take into account the economic contributions of three sectors. We need a full-spectrum economic map that also takes into account the life-sustaining sectors. And those are the natural economy, the volunteer community economy, and the household economy. Now, again, people are going to say to you, wait a minute, how can you quantify the value of that work? Well, not only can you, but it's being done. Unfortunately, it's still only in so-called satellite reports. You know, it's not part of the main event. But, for example, the Swiss. Now, I always like to talk about the Swiss because they're not exactly the most radical nation in the world. They did a satellite report measuring the economic value of the work, unpaid work in households, which is mostly the work of caring, caregiving, keeping a clean home environment, mostly still done by women worldwide. And they found that if that work were included, it would constitute a whopping 40% of the reported Swiss GDP. Other satellite reports show a value, depending on how you measure it, and we don't have time to go into that, between 30 and 60%. Nonetheless, even most economic measures that are now being developed as alternatives or supplements to GDP, while some of them are getting better on environmental matters, do not take into account the value of this work of caring for people. And this is why we simply cannot continue, you know, with this tunnel vision of our thinking. And I'm going to suggest to you that not giving value and visibility to the work of caring for people, starting in early childhood, is not only terrible for humans, right? But that it is absolutely suicidal for an effective economic system in our knowledge service post-industrial economy. Consider that economists never tire of telling us that for this new era, the most important capital is what they like to call high-quality human capital. You've heard that, haven't you? Well, that is not just produced in universities, my friend. We know from neuroscience, not just psychology and sociology, that whether or not that high-quality human capital is or is not produced heavily hinges on the quality of care and education that children receive very early on. We just had the Caring Economy campaign just held a congressional briefing on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C., basically on the value, that's right, the economic value of the work of care and of early childhood education. I urge you to look for more information about that at our website, caringeconomy.org. But the point is this, and I want to close on that. You may ask yourselves, well, why is this work so devalued, right? It doesn't make sense. Well, that's why, as Chip said, we really have to go much, much deeper to look at the roots of the dysfunction. And again, think outside the box and start thinking of matters that are not part of the conventional dialogue. And this is the status of women and of children. And I know you're not used to thinking of economics. You know, after all, these are just women's or just children's issues. I mean, we're the majority, but that, which is irrational to call it just that, of course. But consider that we even have empirical evidence showing that there is a very direct relationship between a nation's general quality of life and its economic competitiveness and the status of women. In fact, we did such a study at the Center for Partnership Studies. It was a pioneering study in time for the 1995 UN Women's Conference in China, in Beijing. And we found, by comparing from 89 nations, statistical data comparing the quality of life, you know, all the way from access to potable water and human rights ratings, environmental ratings, on the one hand, and measures of the status of women, that in significant respects, the status of women is a better predictor of general quality of life and economic success in the long term than GDP. And later studies, including the World Economic Forum's Global Gender Gap reports, show the same thing. So I'm going to invite you. I'm going to invite you to become part of this enterprise, because economics are foundational. The old thinking is a dead end, and worse. We need what I call a caring economy. So start talking about a caring economy, and people are going to say, oh my gosh. Well, that's how you change the conversation. Think about it, and I'm going to end with this. In the European Middle Ages, the normative ideals were fealty, right? Obedience. And then we started to talk about freedom, about equality. Now, just talking about it doesn't do it, mind you. But talking about it is important. So I invite you not only to talk about it, but become part of our program. We have a wonderful online leadership and learning program. We have a coalition, now organizations representing over 14 million people. Get your organization to join the Caring Economy Coalition. Let's do it. We can do it. Economic systems are human creations. They will change, but the direction in which they change and whether or not it's a caring direction is up to us. So let's do it for ourselves, for our children, and generations to come. I thank you.
Thank you, excuse me, Rianne Eisler, for your wonderful comments. Let us do it. That sounds very, very important and is very, very important. You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California, the 30-year plan, what we need to do to build a better future, with Orion Magazine, and featuring three of the 30 writers who responded to that question in the book, 30-year Plan. We're welcoming today our moderator, H. Emerson Blake, editor-in-chief of Orion Magazine, and authors Craig Childs, Rianne Eisler, and Ruben Martinez, right, Ruben? I'm sorry about that. We'll go ahead and continue with Craig.
So we're talking about the future inside of a room. We have a ceiling over us and walls around us, a full floor underneath us, and it's easy to forget that we are in a much larger world. That, I mean, you can hear a little bit outside that there is something going on, but you know when you open the door and you leave this building, when you leave any building, you walk outside and everything changes. You can smell things. The things are moving. There are dynamics all around you, and you see clouds going by. So you know that there is a bigger world beyond our small focus inside of all these buildings. And I think often that this is such a recent invention of ours that we're inside all the time, that we are in civilization. And we've adapted fairly well. I don't think we've all gone mad, or maybe we have, and this is what it looks like. But this is new for us, that we are separate from the tactile changing world of tides and storms, and we're not entirely separate from it. In fact, in a way, we're not separate at all, because we are heavily under the influence of these things, of changing climates and sea levels and storms and lunar patterns. We are influenced by these things, but we it's so easy to forget about it because we are inside, because we are separate from that world so often. And as a writer, I feel like my job is to go out into that world and bring stories back, because I'm often trying to hold on to the experience in the wilderness and bring it back and say, well, here's what it's like. Here's what it's like to be stalked by an animal or to stalk an animal, or here's what it's like to wander through the desert for weeks looking for water. These are these elemental, visceral experiences. And I, as a writer, I'm trying to hold on to that and say, don't forget. I know that we're diving into smartphones and transit buses and that world, but don't forget, there's this other world that we've been in for millions of years that we know how to live in. We know how to breathe and walk and move. And when you go out into that world, you realize that there are stories being told. When I just last week I went down the Colorado River in Utah. I made this Huck Finn contraption of two canoes with a plank of plywood in between them, and my wife and I and another parent and four kids under 10 all piled onto this thing, and for 4 days we floated down the river, and you're going through these deep sandstone canyons where you can see these stories of the past written in the rock. You get up against this sandstone and you can see 200 million year old winds recorded inside the rock where sand was laid down, and you see these layers going thousands of feet up, and you realize each one of these layers is a different environment, a different time, a different planet. And when you understand that, when you understand how much this planet has changed, how old it is, how long things have been here, it changes your perspective on the human position here. And you get a sense of how unstable this planet is, how much it has been different in the past, where you're looking through environments in these rock walls going, okay, well, this was underwater. This was 400 feet under the sea. Then this was a rainforest, and then this was an estuary, and this was a desert. And you realize this planet is not just this level playing field that we believe it is sometimes. It is this dynamic place that is radically altering all the time. My writing in this book, I was up in St. Lawrence Island, in the Bering Sea, north of the Aleutian Island chain, just within view of Siberia and out of view of Alaska. I was up in a Siberian Yupik village of Savunga, and at the time I was going out with this Siberian hunter, or this Yupik hunter, who was taking me out into the tundra, and I was just following him around on his rounds, and what he was hunting on that day was artifacts. He goes out and digs up ancient villages and sells the artifacts that he finds. And he can do this because this island is a native incorporated island, and they can do whatever they want with their own ancestry there. And so he sells objects that are 2,000 years old that he digs out of these villages. And, you know, there are all kinds of ethics with that. But it was interesting to be with him out there, where he's saying, well, I'm digging up these things that my ancestors left for me so that I can live in a cash economy. And I sell them out in the world. And we were traveling out to this ancient ruin, which is just a mound out in the tundra right on the coast. He was telling me that oh, the digging is good here, but if you really want to find the good artifacts, you have to go out to sea, because the villages are out there under the water. And I had gone to this island because I was writing about sea level rise. And I wanted to say, here is a place that if you had stood here 10,000 years ago, you would have been 500 miles from the nearest shoreline. Sea levels have risen 450 feet since the ice age. And If you had gone back to the Ice Age, sea levels were down because the water was locked up in ice in glaciers around the world, and you would have been in the middle of the Bering Land Bridge connecting Siberia to Alaska. And you can imagine it there. You're on this island that is right now a little mountain range. Back then, it would have been the high point on the Bering Land Bridge. For people 20,000 years ago who were traveling across from Siberia, they would have seen that in the distance. It would have been a landmark. And now it is this lone island out in the middle of the Bering Sea. And I think if you had gone back 20,000 years ago and said, hey, you know what it's going to look like here? The sea is going to come in. And, you know, at that time, like I said, it's a 500-mile walk to get to a coastline. And I think they would have thought you mad. And I'm thinking now, okay, what if we tell people now what it will look like in 50 years, 100 years, 1,000 years? Would they think us mad? Do we know how much this world can change? I mean, the villages that are out underwater that were built 2,000 years ago out by the shores, did they know that they would be underwater? You get a sense of time as you go through these landscapes. You get a sense of how things change, how much this world is not the stable place we think of it. And that's when I'm thinking about the future, when I'm thinking about how we can live, I think, oh, there are 7 billion of us now. There are going to be 9, 10, 15, who knows how many billion in the future. Do we know that we live on a planet? Do we know that we live on a place that is shifting out from under us, that we are very much a part of changing all the time? Do we have a sense of time? Do we have a sense of how long things last, how quickly they decay? Do we have a sense of this world in which we live? I mean, we talk about the planet, we talk about the earth. What are we talking about? When we say, save the earth, sometimes it's almost this two-dimensional image. What is the earth? How long does it last? What are the timescales, and where do we fit into those timescales? I think it's very important for us to understand our place in order to go into the future, and that our place is not inside of a room. Our place is on a planet with tides and weather and things changing, seas coming up, climates moving. We are inside of a very dynamic world. And that is a future that I think we need to understand. Thank you.
Thank you, Craig. And again, for our radio audience, you're listening to a program from the Commonwealth Club. And we will move on now to our questions. And we'll do them from the audience, and when I'll come around and hold up your hand, and we'll ask questions. Wait just one moment. Let me get the microphone. So who has our first question?
Mr. Martinez, correct?
Yes.
I once had a psychiatrist that told me he believed it was his opinion that the drugs that drug addicts use should be legalized. He believed in treatment, not apprehension. Do you have a view on that? On should street drugs all? He said they should all be legalized. Do you have an opinion on that?
Yes, yes, I do. Right now, as you were asking the question, what was flashing through my mind was a wonderful viral YouTube clip by the Gregory Brothers. Has anybody seen the Gregory Brothers clip about the drug war? It auto-tunes Ron Paul, Mario Cuomo. No, I'm sorry, not Andrew Cuomo, and several other both Republican and Democratic politicians basically saying, you know, the war on drugs is a failure. We all know this, and we keep on funding it. And we keep on sending billions of dollars to Mexico and to Colombia and to Central America to continue prosecuting the drug war. And rates of addiction continue to increase in the United States, and now they're increasing in Latin America, because interdiction efforts have had something of an impact on the border, how much drugs cross the border. So internal markets are open. So now we get to have devastation on both sides. It would be a pretty, you know, simple thing to turn it back. It's already happening. Everywhere that it's that marijuana is legalized, it's the beginning of the end of the drug war. And it's very much been a citizens' movement. Now, to get from these, you know, kind of like localized movements to something global is going to take a tremendous amount of energy. But once again, just to go with my motif of neighborliness, the drug war in Mexico, we talk about it as the drug war in Mexico, Mexico's drug war. It is our drug war. The blood that is spilled in Mexico translates to addiction on this side. The guns that are used in the terrible crimes in Mexico are coming from the United States. It's our demand for drugs on this side that pulls the drugs across the border. It's our drug war. It's our failure on both sides of that border. We, in this sense, we need to bring that wall between us down.
Hi, my name's Peter Gisella. I have a question for Rhianne. You're advocating for a caring society, and you're looking 30 years into the future. 30 years in the past, back in 1979, as a military veteran, I learned about a bill that was in the Congress that would have challenged you to think about participatory democracy for a year. And it was very comprehensive. It included both males and females, and it would have modified the Selective Service Program. My experience in the military was that we were going to eventually go to war over oil in the Persian Gulf, and that a youth energy corps could help counterbalance that. And I got a couple newspaper articles back in 1980 on how I wrote to the Carter administration, Reagan administration, every member of Congress, and basically got some feedback, but very limited. Since 9/11, I've had 1,000 photographs with people at the Commonwealth Club World Affairs Council. And my question is, I'm trying to create a website that challenges all these experts to provide some feedback towards this program. And unfortunately, I can't even get very much feedback towards how to effectively create a website that challenges these experts, even just a document, no comment from them.
Well, you have really brought up some very important things, and I thank you. I think that I always go much deeper to the underlying system of values. Have you ever wondered why it is that so many politicians always seem to find money for weapons for wars? But when it comes to finding money for caring for people, right, for health care, for nutrition for children, for these soft, yes, stereotypically feminine values and activities, they can't find it. And this is not a matter of women against men or men against women. It's a matter of a system of values we've all learned to internalize, you know, why, for example, do we need social wealth indicators? If we have any chance of eradicating poverty, we have to notice something, which is that the mass of the world's poor and the poorest of the poor worldwide are women and children. According to UNIFEM, 70 to 80% of those living in absolute poverty, which is starvation or near starvation, are female. Now, that's not only because of discrimination. It's because this work of caring, caregiving, including keeping a clean and healthy home environment, which relates directly to what my two colleagues have been talking about, keeping a clean environment. You know, I used to joke about it. I used to say women would never have created nuclear waste with no idea of where to put it. And it's not because women are better than men, but because we're not taught that somebody else, namely a woman, will come and clean up after us. So let's connect the dots here is what I'm trying to propose to you. If you don't go deeper, you can't eradicate poverty. You can't understand that we have inherited. The status of women has somewhat risen, yes, at least in the West, in this country. Men are doing work, for example, that used to be completely unfit for, quote, real men, you know, caring, diapering a baby, feeding a baby, but that hidden system of gendered values is still with us. So if we don't really address that, we are not going to change things, and that's where these social wealth indicators come in. The only way we can effectively do that is to show the enormous, purely economic value of the return of investment in care work and education starting in early childhood. So again, I really invite you to join the Caring Economy campaign. Your website probably can find lots of material on our site, caringeconomy.org. And let's have our spiritual courage, really, to challenge, because people are uncomfortable talking about gender, okay? But I want to leave you with something. The great sociologist Lewis Wirth said it. He said the most important things about a society are those that people are uncomfortable talking about. We saw it with race. Only when we started to talk about it did we begin to move forward. We've got to talk more about the underlying issues of this gendered system of values. And it's up to you to change the conversation, reframe the economic conversation.
Hello, my name is Tomathana Siu. I've actually written for Orion. This is a comment for Emerson Blake. And I think it's about time scales. 30 years is an interesting time scale. And I work almost entirely on climate change. In fact, I work on the global negotiations. And there's all kinds of fantastic stuff changing slowly. And you write about many of those things in your magazine. But what increasingly concerns me and many other people in the climate world is urgent mobilization. And I think when you talk about urgency or think about urgency and you ask what humanity needs, I actually think we know the answer very precisely. My question is, what we know very precisely is that the answer is we need the kind of economic redistribution that enables large-scale and robust cooperation in an emergency. And so my question is about the kind of metaphorical way in which your magazine is written, which is, how do you get, this is a question. How do you get to something specific like that, something specific which is an economic and political challenge, in this real writerly way? It's to me, it's every time I read your magazine, that's the question I have in my mind.
Well, as to your question as to why we selected a 30-year time frame, part of it is simply that we had had a 30-year anniversary, and we found ourselves thinking in terms of where we were going as an organization and what we thought we needed to anticipate for the next 30 years and what kind of impact that we wanted to have as an organization. And as I think we noticed as we looked around at how other people were talking about how we have to be prepared for the future. People would talk in 50-year intervals and 100-year intervals, and you see a lot of that. And we thought that that was too long. That's not a practical length of time. We need something that's much more confined than that. We need something that's much more urgent than that. And 30 years to us seemed like a practical piece of time to talk about for how to begin to enact change. As far as your question about the magazine and the metaphorical content of the magazine, I think this. What I think of are the comments that Craig was just making about the power of storytelling in engaging us to think about how the future can be different. I think storytelling reinforces the question of why that question is important. The question of how we change, I think, is a question that many, many organizations, many, many people have taken up. And Orion, as an organization, part of our mission within all of the work of other organizations is to be unleashing people's imagination for what's really possible, and to be encouraging the possibility that we can go farther than we think.
Can I address the question of redistribution for a moment? Because that is exactly what the caring economy is about, but not from the conventional perspective. I'll give you an example. Nations like Sweden, Norway, and Finland, at the beginning of the 20th century, they were so poor that there were famines. People, Minnesota, you know, whole states got populated by people fleeing. Today, these nations are invariably in the highest ranks of both the human development reports of the United Nations and the World Economic Forum's global competitiveness reports. A major factor in that was caring policies. They didn't redistribute in the conventional way of that's often suggested of a stipend to everybody. They invested in caring for their people, in helping families care for children, in high-quality early childhood education, in generous paid parental leave for both mothers and fathers. In Norway, even in Social Security credit for the first 7 years of caring for a child at home, whether by a woman or a man. That is a sensible way of redistribution that not only invests in our human capital, it's a horrible term, but that's what they say, in human beings, in human development, in the development of all of our capacities, but that actually also redistributes. But it doesn't do it. These are not socialist nations. They're not capitalist nations. They have a very healthy market economy. They have very caring economic policies. They often call themselves caring societies. And a major factor, because I'm going to get back to gender, is that there is a much more equal partnership in these nations between women and men in both the family and the state. Women are 40% of the national legislature, and as the status of women rises, this is basic, men no longer feel that it is such a threat to their identity, to their, quote, masculinity, to also back, embrace more stereotypically feminine, caring, caregiving activities. So let's do it. We can redistribute, but not in the old way. So, again, I invite you to join the Caring Economy campaign.
Thank you very much, and thank you to our audience. Unfortunately, we've come to that point in our meeting tonight, our meeting this afternoon, that is time for just one last comment from each of our panelists, one brief last comment from each of our panelists. Marissa, would you like to start as our moderator?
Thank you, Pam. Thank Anne. Thank you, Anne, and thank you all the rest of you for being here. I will just mention that the 30-year plan is available outside the room here, and we invite all of you to have a look at that and also to have a look at the magazine, and we encourage you to subscribe.
I would urge you to leave this building. To go outside whenever possible, to go wherever the sea is touching the shore, wherever there are clouds, go out there.
Well, I already said my closing, so again, I just want to thank you and invite you to join the Caring Economy campaign.
I believe that history will look back on the time that we're living in as a great a moment of great ferment worldwide. Of course, we've lived through the Arab Spring and the troubles, the summer troubles that have resulted from it, but we're also in a time where great communities of solidarity are arising. In Mexico right now, yes, the drug war continues, but communities have banded together across the country in communities of solidarity that are defending themselves from the worst of the violence. And here on this side of the border, tremendous organizing has gone on that is chipping away at the insanity that is the drug war. Rebecca Solnit wrote a wonderful book about the communities of solidarity that arise in times of disaster. We've come out of one of the greatest economic disasters in American history, of course, and I think most of us know that we don't want to go back to that speculative economy, that we do need to get to this type of economy that Rhianne is talking about, and we are taking steps towards that. We see the movement happening now.
Our thanks to our moderator, H. Emerson Blake, editor-in-chief of Orion Magazine, and authors Craig Childs, Rian Eisler, and Ruben Martinez. More information about the new book, 30-Year Plan, 30 Writers on What We Need to Build a Better Future, and about Orion Magazine is available at www.orionmagazine.org. As you can see, we have a variety of wonderful expressions and opinions and thoughts from these three wonderful writers. So I can guarantee you when you get the book, you'll find even more thoughtful, insightful, and guidelines in a way, you know, guidelines about what do we do and where do we go when you read the book. So also on display is the Orion Magazine, and it's also, as I mentioned, available at www.orionmagazine.org. I'm Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Forum, and this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California celebrating more than 110 years of enlightened discussion. So when you think about 30 years, just remember the club has been here for 110 years. I haven't been here for all those 110 years, but here we are. So our meeting today is adjourned. We look forward to seeing and hearing from you at our upcoming, environmental meetings on May 10th for the Exploratorium and May 22nd, Greening the World Through National Major League Sports. Thank you so much for coming and your questions. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.